April is National Poetry Month, and Public Radio 90 observes the occasion by presenting readings by poets from the Northern Michigan University and surrounding communities. Andrew Hillman was born and raised in Omaha, Nebraska. He earned his BA and MA in English at Creighton University and his MFA in fiction from Northern Michigan University. During his time in graduate school, he taught creative writing, composition, and technical writing. He has been published in Fiddlehead magazine and was a finalist for Glimmer Train's Short Fiction Award. His debut novel, World Chase Me Down, was published by Penguin in January 2017. He lives in Omaha with his wife and daughter. We'll hear an excerpt from his debut novel, World Chase Me Down.
The book is about the first successful ransom for a kidnapping in the history of the United States. And Pat Crow is the main character. He's also the first person narrator of the book. And this chapter starts just before Pat and his friend Billy are setting off to kidnap the 16-year-old son of a meatpacking tycoon, Edward Cudahy. So this chapter pretty much details their preparations a couple days before they set off to commit the crime. For the 3 months leading up to the kidnapping, Billy and I had rented a frame cottage on a lane north of Grover Street that belonged to an old German seamstress. The house, vacant for more than a year before our arrival, had fallen in disrepair. The roof was patched up like a quilt with squares of heavy nap cloth that swelled during rainstorms and leaked runoff into pots and buckets. The floorboards were warped. Plaster crumbled off the walls. Wallpaper peeled down in long curls. Once painted white, the house had been stripped of nearly all its color, and the exposed wood had rotted from the elements. There was a good barn at the back of the property that was nearly as big as the cottage itself. The home sat on a pronounced slope of upland above the southwest corner of the city, just beyond the South Omaha limits. The hillside leading up to the sandy drive was covered in dead wildflower, so parched from the winter that it broke apart underfoot like dust. From the main window at the back of the house, we had a view of the Union stockyards and the Cudahy packing houses pitched in the valley below. I stared out the window for more than an hour before settling on the rent. The cottage was perfect. "We'll need to fix it up some," Billy said. I disagreed. "Yeah, what this outfit needs is some Irish lace on the windows." "If I'm to live in a place, it's got to be livable," Billy said. "Well, it ain't the penthouse of the Belvedere, I'll give you that." Billy paced the main room and then wandered into the kitchen. I followed him, watched him examine every crack and crevice. "I guess it'll do," Billy finally said. "I'm guessing it will," I replied. For a whole month, we set about preparing the house. We pasted oatmeal paper on all the windows to cut out the sunshine. There was a gun rack on the wall to the left of the front door where we could stash our rifles. I bought a few pieces of discount furniture into the hideaway, a wicker rocker, a pair of ladder-back chairs with rope-bottom seats, a kitchen table full of knots, a pair of collapsible iron cots. Billy cleaned out the wood stove, which had been inhabited by a pair of rattlesnakes honeymooning for the autumn. He nearly got bit twice trying to shoo the rattlers with a willow broom, and finally unloaded 6 shots from his revolver into the stove. He missed both snakes entirely at point-blank range, but made them uncomfortable enough to slither out of their iron nest so he could finally sweep them past the front door. He fired 5 more rounds as they bellied away into the weeds and missed again altogether. I watched with a smile from the front porch, my hands dug into my trousers, my pipe crooked in my mouth. "That's some fine shooting." Billy spun around. He didn't know why he was being watched. He nodded at the snake slithering away. "You go to hell. They're skinny." "I've seen kids with slingshots go at more accuracy than you," I said. "I've been domesticated some," Billy said. "Suppose you have. Suppose I'll just keep you on the scattergun," I replied. Billy cursed and went back into the cottage to put some wood into the stove to heat up the drafty front room. I set about to the chores of stocking the pantry and barn. Oats and carrots and sugar cubes for our pony we had yet to purchase. Brandy and ham and banana taffy for me and Billy. I made several trips into town to shop for a good horse and a used buggy, before settling figures on a white mare with a silver star on its forehead, and an old Stanhope with a collapsible carriage top. The horse was an agreeable creature, with a pearl mane and enough life left in her to pull a good draft. I fell to liking her immediately. Billy was as indifferent about the animal as he was the cottage and everything else. It seemed he'd lost all sense of wonderment in life. All month long he mooned about in a droll. The man couldn't even manage the enormity of the moment we were about to create. Nothing I said or imagined could stir Billy's emotions. There was only the salving of pain with brandy and whiskey and plenty of it until the first thin light creased over the hills and the pain returned harder and more pronounced than it had the day before. For 5 weeks we studied the comings and goings of the Cudahy home. Billy sat in the carriage with the top raised for cover, while I stood in company with our white horse, puffing my clay pipe. We spoke little, and when we did converse, we talked in hushed tones. In the afternoons, young Eddie Jr. came home from school around 3 o'clock. He played shinny with his friends in the street before supper time, and practiced his piano in the front room. The evening hours were spent holed up in his room with his school books, and the hour before his bedtime was largely employed at his father's billiards table. We followed him in the evenings on his occasional errands. We lurked in the shadows between the flicker of lampposts. I made notes about his routine on a line pad, noting what times he left the house each day and for how long he was gone. It was a sullen month of winter that December. The weather didn't clear out but for an hour or two at a time. Icy rain fell in nail points, clouds ribbed like needle cord, allowing only for the faintest bit of threaded sunlight. The Missouri River froze overnight only to thaw again the next day. Come the middle of the month, on a rare day clear of weather, save for a few ragged clouds ghosting in a white sky, Billy and I readied ourselves for what would prove to be our final day of observation. I fell out of sleep in a mad dash and got into my woolens to start the kitchen fire. I parched coffee beans in an iron pot and chunked out some water from the cistern pump to brew the beans. Billy was coughing himself awake by the time the coffee was ready. I stepped outside into the quivering morning in my long johns and sheepskin boots to peel a mealy apple and have a morning toke from my pipe. On the downslope toward the river, a huddle of cows stood in a field of dead and snowy clover. A buckboard pitched high with manure passed by on the road below our house, a shovel handle jutting out of the stinking mound. I sat in the front steps and looked south towards the stockyards. I peeled my apple bald as a stone, bounced on the porch railing and undid the flap of my woolens and pissed off the front porch. Billy said, "We take the kid tonight." I auditioned the idea in my head. "Supposed to snow this evening." "I'm not waiting any longer," Billy said. "I wait another day and I might change my mind about the whole damn thing." "Getting nervy on me?" I asked. "Just losing patience is all," Billy said and spit phlegm. He crammed a plug in his lowers and leaked tobacco from his mouth and stirred molasses into his coffee mug. "We ought to have us a pail of suds, steady our grit." "No grog," I said. "We need to be clear-headed." "You got that letter finished?" Billy asked. I nodded. We went over to the plan step by step for the remainder of the day. After supper, we readied ourselves for the crime. New weather filled out over the city, a high batting of snow clouds waiting for sunset, a scarred sky veined with the last light of day. We sat our buggy down a winding farm road of packed sand. The temperature dropped 10 degrees in less than an hour by the time we ambled our coach into the city. The winter sun pulsed like muscle over the naked trees. Everywhere inescapable, angry cold. Billy wrapped himself in his monkey fur and sat chattering his teeth. 20 minutes passed and young Eddie returned home from academy on his regular clockwork, his school book slung over his shoulder by a belt strap as he kicked a stone down the sidewalk. I watched him and scribbled another calculation on my nickel pad. I tamped down my pipe bowl and said, "The kid keeps schedule better than the railroad." "I could have told you that 3 weeks ago," Billy said. "I did tell you that 3 weeks ago. Then 2 weeks ago. Then last week I told you the same thing." "We can't even rush it," I said. "There's only one chance we'll ever have." Billy reached down and took his rifle out of its scabbard. He laid it across his lap to admire its weight and polish before wagging the gunstock at the Cudahy house. "Let's get it over with, then. Let's take him tonight," he said. "Not yet." "There's one thing left to do," I replied. "There's nothing left for us in the whole world but this," Billy said, and slid the Spencer back into its housing. I need to go see him one last time. The kid? Billy asked. The old man. The old man, Edward Cudahy? Yeah, Edward Cudahy. You cannot be serious, Billy said. I cannot be anything else, I replied, and situated myself again on the buckboard. I took the reins from Billy and clucked my tongue to get our pony marching. Dusk dimmed the earth in a giant fold. Around the corner of Dewey Avenue, wagon traffic clogged to a standstill. A dog had run into the lane only to be trampled under hoof by a string of stagecoach ponies. Three dirty Polish children in black rags were weeping over the stomped bones of their beloved shaggy pet, the mother trying to shoo them back inside away from the horror. While we sat watching for the bottleneck to clear, Billy spit tobacco in giant globules. I lent the iron lantern dangling from a rod over my wagon seat. A man, presumably the father of the family who had just lost their pet, had wrapped the dog in a blanket and was carrying it back toward their house with his sobbing children following him. We finally crossed the avenue where the poor mutt had been trampled, lopped over a sopping wet mushroom field in the new snow as the sky pinked. Seeing the dead dog reminded me of another time long ago when my first horse had drowned in a flash flood. I was 13 years old and living for a summer on my uncle's ranch in Shinbone, New Mexico. The desert rains came heavy that night and washed the sky clean of all atmosphere, as if it were picture glass. I thought hard on that moment as Billy and I pulled into the lane leading up to our Grover Street cottage. We'd barely escaped the flood that night, me, my uncle, and two cousins. A rain of such weight had flattened crops into tillage and bent corn stalks at the knees. The floodwaters often places deep enough to drown a horse with a current like a river. And drown my nag it did, an old $20 California horse as reliable as sunrise. The poor beast carried away on its back with its legs flailing in the air. How easy it was to be carted off this life. All night I could think of naught else. Be it beast or man, rich or poor, strong or weak, it was all too easy for any of us to be swooped up by darkness in a single whoosh, screaming and screaming.
Joan Roberts is a student at NMU in paralegal and criminal justice. She's graduating at the end of the year, and she started writing poetry 8 years ago due to a tragic event in the family involving recovered memory therapy and false memories. She'll be reading some of her original poetry today.
The poem was written for our daughter, and it was about her last week at home before she started this therapy. The homecoming. Your bedroom stands empty. No one's allowed in. It's all shiny new. Case you come home again. Trimmed peachy in color, matches your face, walls cheery and sunny, with joy you'll embrace. Through your window, sun shines bright, but the bed's so cold, it just isn't right. A nightmare, a mishap, something's gone awry. Mama comes in the morning, just stares as she cries. Little sister sneaks in, looking for you, straightens the covers, neatens your shoes. Remembering the days, the fun you both had, playing cleaning girls, scribbling words on a pad, writing notes to Mama, who's cooking downstairs, singing praises to God as dinner she prepares. Satan came in the window, pushed you out the door. Our bubbly girl, she ain't here no more. Bouncing to Daddy as he came from work, Satan can't take memories. We know he's a jerk. But we have a God and friends that know just how much love our home did bestow. We pray every day, wisdom we seek, like it says in Matthew, blessed are the meek. We look for the rainbow beyond darkened skies. We pray you'll know it's one big lie. The truth is coming, I feel it just now. The hurts will heal, though we don't know how. God will get the glory after all the contention. You'll lie in your bed. Oh, did I mention? You'll rest and rejoice in your own safe domain. Your piano sits quiet, but you'll play it again. The joy, the laughter, the singing, the books. Satan can't have you. He'll just have to look. He's over. He's done with. He tricked and he lied. God's much more powerful. Been there at your side. Your bedroom sits empty. It's calling for you. Even its contents, how you'd arranged it anew. New carpet, new trim, new curtains, new paint. Can't wait till you see it. We think you'll just faint. We hear you coming. We see your face. Up the stairs, we see you race. We sense your feelings. We know you found that which was lost, safe and solid ground. God answers prayers. In him we trust. He ousted Satan. We knew he must. Sister cheers, dad delights. From work he comes and is greeted right. They bring out guitars, you grab your fiddle. Y'all pick and grin, oh, just a little. The music is back, our voices sing. Song so old, it's a family thing. We have faith, the call will come. The one that says, please take me home. Love, Mama. I want to believe. I want to believe this didn't happen to me. But I'm so afraid. Lord, can't you see? They twisted my mind. Made pictures so vivid. The horrible thoughts made my family livid. My heart knows the truth. Will my mind ever see what all the medications have done to me? Images in my mind started from a book. Please help me, Lord, take a closer look. I let fear grip me instead of you. Lord, help me see what's really true. Satan tricked me again. I need freedom from his hold and wisdom to throw out all the lies I was told. The lies are huge, the stories profound. None of it's true, a theory without ground. My little sister, she misses me. She can't understand. She is special, you see. I'm so homesick for my real family. Lord, please destroy those pictures my mind was made to see. I don't want to play all those games in my head. I want to hug Mom and Dad and go home instead. Tell those who played with me to get a life. All they've done is cause me strife. The truth will come out, and they will see. What really happened was none of what I was made to believe. False memories. They've changed me up. I'm really down. I used to be happy all the way around. They call it restoration. It's really a scam. I'm mentally entranced, not sure who I am. A new identity, bad therapy and pills, makes me feel crazy and often quite ill. To all my siblings, I was the drama queen. To bad counselors, I'm the money machine. I can't escape my captors. They keep me for their own, even threatened my parents if they came to their home. Please pray with my family that I let God set me free. I want to be Sissy. I need to be me. It's Just Pretend, written for victims of memory. They took my sister. They took my brother. Pretty soon, they took another. They took my father. They took my mother. They replaced them with someone's other. I have no grandfather and no grandmother. They replaced them with just another. No cousins or uncles, not even aunts. When I wanted home, they said, you can't. They'd made me spew lies and play their games. They even made me change my name. They took my money, left me in sorrow. You can't even imagine all the horror. I espouse false hate, perverse memories and lies. They control my thoughts, but it's all a disguise. With content unknown, I sign typed letters. They promise me that I will get better. I'm worse each day. They ignore the facts. To therapy I go, just to repeat the acts. It's money for them. I'm a star pupil. They're so protected and without scruples. Memory school is a torturous situation. We all regress. There's never graduation. We have medications. Read the same books. To anything helpful, we can't even look. We're controlled, manipulated, in constant pain. To multiple therapists, we're financial gain. There are special codes, secret and confidential. For licensees, memories hold great potential. We are victims of laws. They have special protection. Mental health dictates in every direction. My life is a facade. Just like the diagnosis, mental health created a bogus psychosis. It's just pretend. This poem is called The Power of Injustice, and this is to help the judicial system to see that maybe there's been some things they've been unaware of concerning this false memory topic. Is justice just, or are we out of touch? Is freedom bought, real investigations not? Do man-made tests dictate arrest? Are plea bargains outside legal margins? Who runs the show? Who really knows? Is money an actor to plea benefactors? Are illicit deals of questionable zeal creating convicts through coercive predicts? Convicting for convenience, leaving the culprit to deviance, is that protection or prosecutor rejection? Are facts suppressed, subpoenas in contest, to save face of those in disgrace? If truth be concealed and never revealed, is the victim rejected, the vulnerable unprotected? Refusing search warrants is quite abhorrent, shows little respect for investigation edicts. Harboring the guilty creates justice futility. The powers that be need set victims free. Obstructing litigation is but a proclamation. Lawyering is a game of fortune and fame. Are courts blinded, members sidewinded? Tribunal unwittingly, fraud commit thee.
These National Poetry Month readings are a Public Radio 90 production, recorded and produced in the facilities of WNMU-FM at Northern Michigan University. I'm producer and host Kurt Hosworth. Thanks for listening.